Record. Hi, my name is Nuhaman Demoku, and I am at the Mural Room at Shabazz Center for Intellectual Inquiry at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire, and I'm doing a Zoom interview with Robert Bennett, who is in his house in Metro Atlanta, Georgia. Today is October 27th, 2021, and this is an interview for the Dartmouth Black Lives Oral History Project. Hello, Mr. Bennett. Thank you so much for joining me today. First, I'd like to learn a little bit about your childhood. Can you please state when and where you were born?
I was born in Columbus, Georgia, in the United States in 1947, April 14, 1947.
Can you please tell me the name of your parents?
My whom parents?
Yeah.
I've never known my father. Mm-hmm. My mother is, her name is Ann, and the surname is the same as my Bennett.
What was it like growing up in Georgia?
Well, I left as a little boy when I was 10 years old, and me and all my buddies, we just had a lot of fun playing all the time. Of course, in a rigidly segregated, racially segregated community. Although the white people did not live very far from us, meaning the white neighborhoods were not far from us at all. Just maybe a half a block or so. And so we knew some of the white children, boys our age, and there was some limited play with them as well, but extremely limited. So my world growing up was, except for that limited playtime with them, was strictly amongst Black people. It was, we went to segregated schools and walked, had to walk a good distance. The Black school, or the African American school, was, I can't say really how many miles from our home, but I'm gonna guess it was several miles. And we walked right past a white school, elementary school, on our way to the Black school. Walked through the white neighborhood, which was very close, adjacent to the Black neighborhood. So we knew our place in American society at that early age, meaning a place that the white people had forcibly reserved for us. And as young children, we didn't question it. And we just accommodated ourselves to it as our parents and grandparents did.
Mm-hmm. At a young age, what was your concept of race, like growing up? Like about like segregation and everything? Like what was your interpretation of everything that was going on?
Well, at that age, my concept of it, of the segregation, was that it was the way of life for the white people and Black people, the white people on top in every way, and we were on the bottom in every way. It was a way of life, but our people and my people, family, did not accept it, meaning that we did not embrace it. But it was something that we were forced to live with, so to speak. And at that time, there, when I was just a young child like that, in that era, there wasn't a very public display of resistance to that. But there was resistance. That I knew very well. My mother, my grandparents with whom I live, and others in my family and neighbors, et cetera, they hated the fact that we were an oppressed people, and they clearly to be honest about it, they had a very harsh view of white people. When I say a very harsh view, meaning that they knew, obviously, far better than I did, the cruelty of the oppression and suffering of Black people at the hands of white people in the system which they had created. And so that was expressed. And so as a young child, I knew that. But also being a young child at that age, we did a lot of playing. Sports, my buddies and I, sports of all kinds. We didn't have any store purchased or store bought toys. We made our own toys. So the baseball bat was a stick of some kind or another. And the ball was, you name it. We, all kinds of things we used to make the balls. Rags, balled up rags, et cetera, that type of thing. But anyway, we played, had a very good time.
When you look back in your childhood, is it like mostly negative or positive? Like, what do you, like when you think back on your childhood, like in regards to the time period you were growing up in, how do you look back on it?
It was very positive. We were an oppressed people, without question, but at the same time, we didn't live that way. The school that I attended, Claflin Elementary School, was founded several years after the Civil War in the United States. The original Claflin, I think, was built in 1868. The United States Civil War ended in 1865. So it was started almost immediately after the Civil War. And it was one of the first official public schools for Black people in the United States. So the school, by the time I got there, it was it had a long history and a storied history, and the Black people in Columbus, Georgia, where the school was located, where we all live, but were very proud of the school. So the school was, that elementary school was a very positive place for me. The teachers were all Black, of course, and they had a very strong commitment to the Black students. So we did not grow up, I did not grow up with a negative self-image at all. It was just opposite, very positive. And the teachers were very demanding, meaning that they had very high standards, and that was positive. And on Sundays, we all went to church, so the church was a real focal point of community activity. And to a very large extent, the school was too, because we did not have many institutions and were not allowed very many institutions in which we could socialize with each other, that type of thing, et cetera. But generally, it was not a self-contained community, but because we had to, a self-focused community in a way. We didn't reach out to white people because it was too dangerous to do so.
Can you elaborate on that?
It was too dangerous?
Yeah.
Well, the white people, the history of the oppression of black people in the United States, of course, is known worldwide, and it was very brutal treatment of black people, very cruel treatment of black people here in the United States, of course, as slaves, and then the post-slavery period. White people controlled the police. All the policemen were white, all the authorities were white, public authorities, civil authorities were white. And they were determined that we be kept in our place, in our position. And so we knew that. And so there weren't any friendly reactions to whites. They were the employers, our people were employees, et cetera. And so it was always important never to cross them. Meaning that didn't necessarily try to be friends with them, but we know we had to accommodate ourselves to them because they were at times, it was a very arbitrary rule on their part. So the slightest mistake in some instances could result in their violence against us, using their police force or the police force and the vigilante groups that were forever present in the South.
Can you spell out the elementary school you went to?
Can I what now?
Spell out your elementary school that you were referring to earlier.
Spell out, you mean?
Yeah.
What do you mean spell out?
Like spell your-
The name?
Yeah, the name.
Oh, spell the name of the school. Claflin, C as in Charles, L A F as in Frank, I N as in Nancy, Claflin School. It was elementary school. I think it may have been a bit more than elementary school when I was there. And Claflin, the school was named after a well-off white philanthropist from the from somewhere in New England, I think it was. And there is a college in the state of South Carolina, I believe, that's named after him as well, called Claflin College or Claflin University, something like that.
Going back on how you're talking about your interactions with white people growing up, did you ever have any like negative experiences with white people, whether it's other students or authority?
Well, of course, the oppression itself was a very negative experience. So I had that direct experience. But in terms of personal confrontations with whites, in my lifetime, I never really had that. No, not as a child growing up. Actually, when I was in middle school or junior high school, I lived in Cincinnati and I went to an integrated junior high school. And it was a working class school, meaning white working class as well as black working class. And we generally got along very well, both whites and blacks, and have a lot of fond memories from that. Then when I was in high school in Chicago, and it was a segregated high school there, all black high school. So I wasn't in school on a day-to-day basis with white people, white students, but as I was in junior high school. In all my years of living, I don't recall ever having any really aggressively aggressive confrontations of any kind with whites. No.
Do you have the time periods of where you lived in each of those states and cities?
I didn't understand that.
The time periods in which you lived.
The time periods.
Yeah.
I was born in 1947. I left Georgia, the place where I was born, Columbus, Georgia, when I was 10 years old. So that was 1957 when I left Georgia. My mother left to move to Cincinnati with her then husband, my stepfather. So I lived in Cincinnati for 5 years. It was in 1957 to 1962, I think it was. Then I was in high school for 3 years in Chicago, 1962, 1965. And from there, 65, I went to Dartmouth. Graduating in 1969, of course, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Growing up, what was your family dynamic like?
Well, I lived in my grandmother and my grandfather's household. Probably most Americans at that time, certainly most Black Americans, they were married forever, had lots of children. My grandmother, grandfather had 13 children. My great grandmother had about, oh gosh, I think maybe 18 or so. So there was never a divorce, anything of that sort. The women were very strong. And in many ways, not a matriarchy in a caricature sense that we often see on American television today, but they had a strong presence in the families. And I remember that very well. So we never thought of the women as retiring or meaning that they were just homemakers or anything like that. They worked, as did the men. They didn't make any much money, of course, because the whites simply didn't pay them much money. But just the same, they all worked. So a cohesive family. So when people moved, family members moved away to the north, as we all called it, someplace in New York City or Chicago or Detroit, Michigan, everybody always visited the family home at some point during the summertime, then oftentimes at Christmas or something like that. So that was a given that our family members who were scattered in the northern cities, the younger generation who had moved north, would always go back south to see the grandmother and grandfather. And then in my case, when I was young, the grandchildren were always sent back too. When I lived in Cincinnati, I went south to see my grandmother and grandfather every summer.
Do you remember like any stories that your grandparents had told you about like the time period they grew up in?
I remember, my grandfather complaining about white people and the treatment of Black people. I remember that very well. My grandmother worked in a home, meaning she was a homemaker, but at that time, like so many African American women or Black women, she did laundry for white people, meaning she washed the clothes and ironed the clothes for certain white wives, white women. The white women would bring the clothes, the dirty laundry to our home. My grandmother would wash the clothes and iron them. It was all perfectly done. Just meticulously done. But as far as the stories go, it was my grandfather who was the most talkative one. So he would talk about experiences of Black people in Columbus, Georgia, And I remember some of those stories, yeah. Not all of them pleasant.
Mm-hmm. What did your mother do growing up? Like, what was her career?
My mother, I remember the first job she had, it was, she worked at Tasty Sandwich Shop, white owned, I think delicatessen would be a word that we would use today to try to explain it a little bit or describe it, but it was not anywhere at that level of delicatessen. But anyway, this white owned business made sandwiches, and my mother worked there. I remember that. And then later, she went to nursing school and became a licensed practical nurse.
Do you have any siblings?
I have two brothers and a sister. We share the same mother, but not the same father.
Are you the oldest?
Yes, I am.
What role did you play in the family? Like,
I lived apart from my mother and my two brothers and my sister from about 14, when I was 14 years old. So I was not a part of that family structure. And I'm 10 years older and 9 years older than my oldest brother. So I never really grew up. I did not grow up with them, no. But I always saw them. They lived in Chicago for a brief period when I was there living there. Then they moved back to Columbus, Georgia at some point when I was still in high school. And that was the last I actually lived with them. So I lived with them for a very short period of time. My family dynamic, so to speak, meaning my living with them, it really wasn't, as I just said, a situation which I actually lived with them directly, no.
During that period where you weren't living with your mom, who are you living with?
During that period when I wasn't with my mom, what?
Who are you living with?
In Chicago, when I was in high school, my mother was back in living in Columbus, Georgia. I stayed with an uncle and then with some family friends. So I moved around a bit. But my high school years were that way in terms of family. Mm-hmm.
Were there any other reasons you were living with your uncle and other family friends instead of your mom?
Well, I did not want to. When my mother decided to go back to the South, back to Columbus, Georgia, I was in high school, just starting high school in the ninth grade. And I didn't want to go back South. I wanted to stay in the high school, which I attended in Chicago. And I wanted to live in Chicago, not the South. I knew enough about what was going on to not want to live in the South.
What was going on during that time?
Well, as I described to you earlier, the Black people in the South, throughout the United States, had a very limited, an extremely limited ceiling. But it was a little bit higher in the North. And so I did not want to live in that extremely limited ceiling that prevailed in the South. It was a little higher in the Chicago, and because I was a very good student in school, there were opportunities available to me in Chicago that were not available to me in the South. And I knew that even as a 14-year-old. Mm-hmm. So I decided to stay in Chicago. And my uncle lived there, so I stayed with my uncle.
What were some of the opportunities you took advantage of in Chicago?
Well, of course, Chicago is a far bigger city than Columbus, Georgia. And although it was a heavily segregated city, racially segregated city, nonetheless, there was, the Black people made more money than what Black people in the South made. The factories were in the northern cities like Chicago, et cetera. So we were, our people were factory workers. So we, our people had more money to spend, and there was a much bigger Black middle class, if you will, in Chicago than in Columbus, Georgia, as was the case in other northern cities. And so there were more cultural opportunities available in the northern, in the Black communities in Chicago. There's a lot more going on. There were social clubs, there were entertainment venues that didn't exist in the South. There were libraries that we could attend that were well equipped, et cetera. And I, as a high school student, I used to go to the library quite a bit. And so that type of thing, et cetera.
Can you repeat the time period you were in high school?
Again, you repeat it for me.
Can you repeat the time period you went to high school? Like the years?
I just didn't understand what you said.
Can you repeat the years you went to high
school? The years of high school, been 1962 to 1965.
Okay. So you went to high school during the peak of the civil rights movement, which occurred like during 1954 to 1968. What was that like for you?
Well, it was very interesting. Obviously, and I mean, to say interesting, understatement. It was a very exciting period because Black people were resisting this oppression in a very public way throughout the United States. I used to read the newspapers, even as a 13-year-old, daily newspapers, as well as watch television. And so these stories were always on TV, and stories of civil rights demonstrations always on television, of course, and in the newspapers. So I followed all of this, and it was just fascinating. And also in Chicago, fascinating and inspiring. And in Chicago, there was a strong Black nationalist movement. And I was aware of that. There was Malcolm X, for example, one of the most prominent Black nationalist leaders in American history. He was in Chicago all the time. That was the headquarters for the group organization to which he belonged, the Nation of Islam. So I was aware of all of that. And then my two uncles who lived in Chicago, they were very strong Black nationalists, and so I was exposed to all of that too. So it was an exciting time and very positive time for Black people, meaning we're fighting oppression in a very open, very public way.
Did you ever participate in any of like the protests or any of the movements? Like, were you active?
Not until I got to college, at Dartmouth. That's when I did that. But before that, no.
Earlier, you mentioned how you were you had like a lot of opportunities that you wanted to. You had a lot of opportunities. That's why you wanted to stay in Chicago. Can you talk about some of your ambitions that you had during high school?
Well, I, for example. There were many examples, but there was an organization for high schools in Chicago that were called if I can remember the exact name, but the I don't remember the exact name, but it was an inter-school student government, meaning a number of schools in a large district of the city of Chicago had a joint school student council. And there may have been, maybe 10 high schools, for example, or more, maybe 20 high schools, for example, I don't remember, that were part of this inter-school student council. That's the district in which I lived. Must have been, like I said, at least 10 high schools, et cetera. And there were two officers chosen each year for this inter-school student council, a president and a secretary of things. And the officers were chosen by the student council, this joint student council, and the teachers and administrators who oversaw the running of this standard inter-school student council. The officers were chosen by on the basis of oratory. Those who wanted to be, who competed for these officers' position, had to give a speech, a competition, speech competition, speech written by the student and performed by the student in an oration. And so that was something I looked forward to doing because it had a lot of prestige, et cetera. And a student, once you belong to this, you got a chance to go to other high schools, et cetera. So it was really exciting. And so I competed to be one of the two officers. I gave a speech and then I was chosen as president, for example. And that was one such opportunity.
What other extracurricular activities do you participate in during high school?
Oh, I was on the football team. I was the editor of the school newspaper. That was really instrumental for me because it helped me to learn to write. I was on a track team as far as athletics go. I was, there were several academic clubs of which I was a member. One of the clubs was called the Key Club. Exactly what that meant, what it was, I don't remember too well. But at any rate, it was, an honor society of this type, that type, mostly academically centered, but I was part of most of what the high schools offered to the top students at that time.
What was your favorite subject in high school?
What was what like in high school?
Your favorite subject?
History.
Why history?
It's still my favorite subject today. I really love history, reading history and studying history. I like it because it's instructive. It's not only just interesting, but it's very instructive about why we are in the present, how we got to the present. And it's also instructive about how to get out of the present and to make something new. So I always wanted to learn history for that reason. And to this very day, I study history.
Going back to when you became the president of the student council, do you remember what year that was?
That would have been 1964 to 65. September 64 to June 1965, something like that, or May 1965.
Was that your senior year?
That was what?
Your senior year?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What was your main motivation in high school?
I enjoy school, I like school. And my motivation was to be a top student, meaning that to do well in school. It wasn't necessarily to go to Dartmouth or any other Ivy League school or anything like that, but to be a top student, that's for sure. To compete with the very best. Mm-hmm.
Do you think you accomplished that goal?
Yes, I think I did, yeah.
What makes you think that?
Well, I was able to go on to Dartmouth, and I was admitted to all the schools to which I applied. I didn't apply to a lot of them, the universities, that is, but they recruited me. And the first year of the National Achievement Scholarship, I think it was, is called today. It was called that then, too, the National Achievement Scholarship, given to African-American students by the National Merit Foundation. Mm-hmm. That was, the first year was 1965, and a very selective process. And I was one of the chosen students for that scholarship nationwide.
What were the other schools you applied to?
If you remember. Colleges, universities?
Yeah.
I don't remember all of them, but there was just a handful, and they were Midwestern schools. Mm-hmm. Let's see. I believe one of them was McAllister College, I think. And I don't even remember whether that was in Michigan or Wisconsin someplace. I applied maybe to just two schools or so, two colleges, three universities, including Dartmouth. Dartmouth recruited me heavily. And so that was my focus once I started applying. But other than maybe three Midwestern schools or so, plus Dartmouth, that was it for me. And I was accepted at all of those schools, of course, Dartmouth, yeah. So Dartmouth was the number one school of all the ones to which I applied. So I wanted to go there because it was such a highly ranked school, one of the best ranked schools in the United States.
Were there any other reasons you chose to attend Dartmouth College for undergrad?
That was the primary reason. And then the National Achievement Scholarship paid for my tuition for 4 years. And then there were at least one, maybe two African-American cultural groups in Chicago that awarded scholarships also. So they gave me money also, scholarship money also. So I didn't have to, so I had full scholarship attending Dartmouth. And I didn't have to work during my school year at Dartmouth to attend Dartmouth. So, but the fact that it was such an elite school, that was the primary reason for my going there.
Did you work throughout high school?
Yes, I did.
What did you do?
At that time, as I mentioned earlier, there were factories throughout the northern cities, and they employed Black people. And in high school, one could get a summer job fairly easily at these factories. So I worked at my junior year, I worked at one factory, just menial job, but still it was a paid steady income. And then my junior year, my senior year, a summer, I worked at a different factory. So,
how was your transition to Dartmouth College, and how did you deal with leaving your family?
My transition to Dartmouth?
Yeah.
It was not difficult for me. It was relatively easy for me. Well, academically, it was not a problem, except for French. The one course that was the most challenging was the French, speaking French. I had studied 1 year, more or less studied, because the high school didn't have a French program really, but there was one teacher who knew French, but that was not her subject of instruction, but she knew it. So she decided to teach us, some of us who are interested in learning French. Well, we didn't have a language lab. So I knew how to write French pretty well at that time, even in high school, but I couldn't speak it. And when I got to Dartmouth, the student had to speak French, and there was a language lab. So it was an entirely new experience for me being in a language lab. So I struggled with that. But other than that, the courses were not difficult generally. And I took courses, I took the required courses, obviously, but also I took courses that I liked, the history. So anyway, I was a good student at Dartmouth.
What were some of your favorite classes that you've taken?
Some of the activities?
Some of your favorite classes?
Again, history, American history. There were at least a couple professors who were interested in African history, white professors, of course, white professors at that time. So I took those courses too, and they were very, very interesting for me. But the courses I liked most were the history courses. And I was obtained honors in those courses, history courses or whatever.
What was your major when you were at Dartmouth?
History.
History?
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any minors?
I don't know. I don't recall that at all. I don't even know if Dartmouth had majors, minors at that time. But I do remember majors being, to the extent that there was a concentration, it was in history for me. And I received honors in history.
So was this your first time being in a predominantly white institution? Because I know in the past you've been in like intermixed, but I don't know like the percentages.
You're asking if it was the first experience of being in school with whites?
Predominantly white.
Dartmouth, yeah. No, my junior high school years in Cincinnati, 1957 to 1962, were at a white junior high school in Cincinnati, Ohio. So Dartmouth was the second experience. Very different experience, obviously, since it was university level, and I was a resident at the university, at Dartmouth College, rather.
Were they both like in your middle school? Was it like equal, or was it like just a few Black students?
When I was at Dartmouth,
middle school, in your junior high,
it was primarily it was primarily white. It was primarily white. What the percentages were, I don't know, but I do know it was primarily white, and it was in a primarily white neighborhood, but a working class neighborhood as well. And the relationships were friendly between whites and Blacks.
How were the relationships with white people at Dartmouth?
They were cordial and respectful. I didn't have any personal confrontations with whites at Dartmouth. I was very engaged with the student body at Dartmouth, whites and Blacks. So it was a very good experience for me for many reasons, yeah.
What was your most vivid memory you had during your freshman year?
Other than struggling in that French language lab, my most vivid memories, my freshman year, playing on a freshman football team, and The coaches, I remember the coaches' names and some of the things they said. That was a lot of fun. A lot of stress, too, because I didn't want to play football. I preferred to focus on the academic work because I thought Dartmouth would be really, really difficult for me. So I had to study all the time. It wasn't overwhelming like I thought it would be academically. So that's not to say it was easy, because it wasn't. It was very challenging. But at the same time, I was comfortable with handling it, as long as I studied and disciplined myself. So football, that was something I remembered a lot. And then, but also just being at the university, at Dartmouth, and the environment, it was very, very different from what I had experienced or had been around Weiss before. I had never been around the elites of white people, the white elite. And these were the elite students, meaning elite. They were the white elite. And so the culture of wealthy white people, that was new for me. And it was very interesting, very fascinating. So that was, I remember being in that environment for the first time, and finding it a fascinating experience.
Did you ever feel like you were out of place when you were at Dartmouth?
Did I ever feel that I was what?
Out of place?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. I felt quite comfortable there, meaning that how do I put it? I could be a student and was a student just like the other students, white students. That's not to say we were treated equally by the professors or administration, because we were not. But at the same time, it was not overt in terms of any discrimination, anything like that. And there were just a lot of exciting things to do at Dartmouth. Different courses, all kinds of courses, like kind of experiences that any freshman student such as yourself would have, and being on campus of a college or university and being away from home, being in the so-called independent, so to speak. I had all of that, shared all of that, and it was a very exciting time. Mm-hmm. And as I said earlier, being there amongst the white elite was a really eye-opening experience for me, and an exciting experience for me to see the way they live and how they interacted. In fact, I remember, and this is something, maybe I shouldn't say this, I'm not gonna say what I just started to say, but at any rate, the white students used to call the local whites, working class whites, the janitors and workers at the school, Emmets. I'm sure that's not done today, right?
Okay. What does that mean?
Okay, I don't. It was just a pejorative term for lower class, for working class white people that the well off whites use.
How is it spelled?
I never saw it spelled, so I'm. I don't know. So, but that was a term that I remember, and I wonder these days, I'm going to ask some of my fellow classmates if they remember. Working class whites who lived in Hanover, New Hampshire, and cleaned the dormitories and were the groundskeepers, if they remember those people being called Emmets. But anyway, I have to find out. So I guess it may have been something like E-M-M-I-T or something like that. Mm-hmm. But again, I don't know.
Do you think elitism was more of a problem than racism on campus?
If what was?
Elitism, like?
Was more a problem?
Racism.
I don't understand what you mean. If elitism was more of a problem than what?
Racism. Like if they cared more about like how much money you were making versus the race.
No, you couldn't really separate the two. No, it's, they were so integrated. Racism was simply part of the culture. Even Emmets, so-called Emmets, you know, they were racist too. Elitism and racism, they were two sides of the same coin, so to speak, for the Dartmouth student, the white student. They were well off and racist at the same time, meaning that it was simply the part of their culture. Some acted it out in more demonstrative ways than others, but that's the way they lived. That's the way they believed.
How long were you on the football team for?
3 years.
3 years?
Yeah.
Why didn't you do it your last
year? Why did I stay the fourth year? I had a lot of difficulty with the coach at the time, and I thought the coach was a racist. And so I quit at the end of my third year there, which I regretted doing after I'd done it. But I was there 3 years.
Why did you think your coach was racist?
Well, and it wasn't just me, but as it turned out, I was the only Black player on a traveling team. And there had been must have been five of us or so who started out playing and still were there when I was on the traveling team, meaning that when the football team traveled to play other colleges or universities, Harvard, whomever, I was the only Black player traveling. And so basically I thought the coach should have played me more. And I thought he should have played the other Black players and more, but he didn't. So anyway, but the team were very successful teams, but the coach clearly had, he wanted a white team on the field, and we were new to Dartmouth, even though it was just a tiny number of us there. Still, it was a new experience for the coach. That's not an excuse, but at any rate, I thought he was very racist.
Had it been like that all 4 years, or was it?
It was the same. It didn't change. The coaches were the same. Yeah, the 4 years, they're the same.
But you mentioned your freshman year, the coaches were really nice and like they said a lot of nice things.
Well, everybody was very nice. The coaches, the professors, whatever. They were very courteous, smiling. there's a song, Smiling Faces. I don't remember the other part of the song, but anyway, behind the smiling faces were not always the best intentions, I'll put it that way. Mm-hmm. And the best treatment and the most respected treatment, but it was generally a smiling face.
Did you have any personal experience that were like negative towards any like staff member?
No. At Dartmouth?
Mm-hmm.
No, I didn't.
So what was the social life for Black students at Dartmouth? Like, did you often interact with students of other races, or did you stick with other Black students?
Well, there were so few of us there. There were total, maybe 17, 18 or something. 30 at most, I would guess, across four classes. And my class, class of 1969, we started Dartmouth in 1965. I think the class, my class of 1969, starting in September 65, that was the largest number of Black student Dartmouth had ever accepted at one time. And I think about 17 or so, maybe 18 or something like that, no more than that. And it was all male school at the time. Our social life was each other with each other. There weren't any women there. It was a very extremely limited social life and without the means to travel to the fairly nearby women's colleges like Mount Holyoke, Smith, et cetera. We didn't have the means to go to those schools. I mean, nobody had a car could afford a car. And then there are so few Black women students. So, and we didn't try to date any of the white girls. That was something we just didn't do, but at the beginning. So anyway, but once we got more comfortable, then that became an open possibility too. So anyway, very limited social life until we, the Black students, began to change things for ourselves at Dartmouth. The Shabazz House, for example, that was created by members of my generation at Dartmouth. We created a cultural magazine called Black Out, BLACKOUT, magazine of culture, dealing with cultural issues, political issues, et cetera. There was a dance band that our students, my class, the one gentleman, the student who organized it, it was called Uncle Tom's Cabinet, had about five or six members, the trumpet player, drums, I don't remember all the instruments, and then a couple of lead singers who sang all the top soul rock and roll or soul tunes, not rock and roll, but soul tunes at that time, Temptations, the Four Tops, they performed at the on the weekends at different fraternities. So of course it was all Black student little group and they were outstanding. So when they performed every weekend, we the Black students, we'd go to the fraternity house where they were performing and we'd be part of the just the gathering, social gathering, having lots of fun, dancing and that type of thing. That was in our sophomore year, junior year. It didn't take us long to begin to change and make things happen for ourselves. So we created our own social life, including the Shabazz Center there.
How did you do that? Like, what steps did you take to create all those changes?
How do we begin to do that?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we started out on being at Dartmouth to intentionally do what we did. It's just that necessity, so to speak, being the mother of invention, we needed social outlet and we didn't want to be like white people. So we just started creating our own. And we didn't discriminate against whites in any way. We brought them into our culture. So they enjoyed our presence. They enjoyed our activities that we created for ourselves. So Dartmouth became a very different place, starting with the generation of the 1960s, of the Black generation of 1960s, Black student generation of 1960s. Am I making sense to you?
Yeah. So after all those changes, what were the response from other white students?
Oh, they accepted, by and large, they accepted and they embraced us and the changes that we brought to the university. A lot of the, of course, some of the things that we did created a lot of havoc, but there were, of course, a very staunch opposition among not only the student body, but the alumni, et cetera. But over time, we were accepted generally by the whites, and our presence was certainly embraced by them.
You mentioned how like the reaction wasn't always positive. Can you elaborate on that?
The reaction was positive to what now?
Wasn't always positive.
Oh, no, no, not at all. Well, I think you have a little memorandum or a little essay I wrote about the protests against George Wallace.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that's an example of an extremely, if you will, a racist reaction to our presence there and our activities.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I have a couple questions regarding the George Wallace protests. I'm going to ask them now. Okay, so on May 3rd, 1967, former Alabama Governor George Wallace was invited to speak at Webster Hall. He was an extremely problematic and known for shouting segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation tomorrow in his inauguration in 1963. How did you feel when it was announced that he was going to be speaking at Dartmouth College?
Well, we some of us Black students of course we opposed his even being invited, given who he was and what he represented and what he was trying to do in the United States at that time. So we were very vehemently opposed to that. And so we decided to fight it, to resist it, and to do our best to block his speech. And we did.
How did you do that?
Well, we, as you know from the essay, we created a protest group, just a handful of us. We knew where he was going to speak, of course, Webster Hall. And we decided to organize ourselves in the newly created African-American Society, or Afro-American Society, we called it. There were two officers of the Afro-American Society, a president and a chairman of the Political Action Committee. Woody Lee, or Forrester Lee, he was a junior. He was the first president of the Afro-American Society. And Robert Bennett, that's me, was the chairman of the Political Action Committee. And it was a Political Action Committee that was responsible in charge of all these different demonstrations that we conducted, including the planning for the protest against George Wallace. So as the chairman of the Political Action Committee, I was one of the leaders of that protest. So when Wallace came to speak, he was running for president at that time. We knew that he would have, we the students knew that he would have a big press following because it was national news wherever he went. And so we decided to demonstrate against his presence, his speaking at Webster Hall. And we just, the result was such a chaos and bedlam during his speech that he was forced to end his speech to quit talking. And he ran from the stage. So anyway, that created a tremendous uproar at Dartmouth. But a lot of positive came, not only uproar at the school, you know, at the college, but also, of course, among the alumni. And that was a real threat of our being, those of us who participated in the demonstration, being expelled. But we were, I thought I was going to be expelled, but we were not expelled and allowed to continue at the university, and we did. But it was good for this, for the university in many, many ways, because they could, the university community as a whole, the students, the administrators, people in the community at Dartmouth, the alumni, they could see that we Black people were not white. So, and meaning that we were not trying, we were not there to be white people or to become white people in any way whatsoever. And we were not subservient to them at all. And would not ever, and would never be that. And over time, they appreciated that, meaning that they came to respect us for who we are, or more so than they ever did before, I'll put it that way.
Mm-hmm. What role did you play in the George Wallace protests? Like,
well, as I mentioned, I was the chairman of the Political Action Committee, the Afro-American Society. Of course, one of the founders of the African-American Society. I was a sophomore. When we, the sophomores and others, founded the African Black, obviously, founded the Afro-American Society. So I was one of the leaders on the basis of my position in the Afro-American Society, and also just generally, also just being an activist student, so to speak.
So how did you get appointed that position? in the Afro-American society?
Students voted me. The student, when we organized the Afro-American Society, we voted for the, we the students who did organize it, voted to for the two offices. So we, I was chosen for that. Woody Lee was chosen, voted to be the president, and I was voted to be the chairman of the Political Action Committee.
Prior to that, did you have any experience in activism?
No, I did not. No, prior to Dartmouth, I did not know. But that was not the George Wallace protest. Was not the first protest that I and the Black students at Dartmouth initiated and carried through. There were others. There were demonstrations against apartheid in South Africa. Mm-hmm. Part of the demonstrations against the Portuguese. Colonialism in Mozambique and Angola and Guinea-Bissau, meaning that there were speakers from South African government who spoke on behalf of the South African government, and we did our best to give them hell, prevented them from speaking. It didn't make the national news or anything like that, not like George Wallace, but we did that. And so this was a prelude to George Wallace protest. And so it was like a training ground for us. I remember it was a Portuguese representative speaking at Dartmouth, and I don't remember the auditorium, but those of us who Black students who protested, we sat ourselves in the audience and just made a lot of noise, created a lot of chaos. And the speaker was forced to leave the stage. And he went to speak at a fraternity house immediately thereafter. And his supporters, they followed him to the fraternity house. And but so did we, the protesters, Black protesters. So we went there too. And it became bedlam at the fraternity house. It's amazing we didn't get in fights or anything, but the speech did not go forward. So that took place before the George Wallace protest.
Do you remember the date of that?
The George Wallace took place in what, May of 1967? So that would have been I don't remember, January, February, 1967 or so. I don't recall any protests when we were freshmen. I think our activism started when we were sophomores, I believe, first early sophomores. Our freshman year, we were still trying to figure out what was at Dartmouth, so to speak.
What's the process of planning an event like that?
What's the process of what?
Planning any protest? Like what kind of...
What's the process of planning? Oh, well, we did so through the Afro-American Society. We had our, I don't know how often we met, but we had our meetings. And we met at the Afro-Am, who I think we called it Afro-Am or something. We met, I don't remember the name of the building, on a corner of Main Street and right at the main intersection there, right opposite catacorner to the, what was the name of the hotel, the main hotel there? I don't remember.
Hanover Inn?
Yeah, Hanover Inn, yeah. And it was opposite, there was, what was that place? In fact, I stayed there as a senior. Only seniors could have residence there when I was there. I don't remember the name of the place, but it was for the honor to be there. That was on one corner. Hanover Inn was on another. And then there was the one corner was the, of course, entry to the green. And then the other was this administrative building. This was where the Tucker Foundation was or something like that. I don't know if that still exists either. But anyway, we used to meet there. Afro-American Society or Afro-Am or the AM or whatever it became known. So we met there and we did our planning there and then also in each other's dormitory rooms.
Okay, what do you remember from the George Wallace protest? Like, can you give me a timeline of like from the beginning?
One second, just a minute, yeah.
Okay.
remember, what do I remember about the George Wallace protests? Most remember, or most salient points, so to speak? One is,
or give me like a timeline of everything that happened.
A timeline?
Mm-hmm.
well, I won't, don't want to go into too much detail, but anyway, we did plan the event. And if we had a mission, a stated purpose among ourselves, which was to make this demonstration national in terms of the press coverage of the demonstration. That was, now as I look back on it, of course, that was extremely ambitious, but we didn't want to be on TV or be mentioned in the national press just for the sake of trying to gain some notoriety or something like that. But the purpose was to be part of the national resistance to racism and the fascism that George Wallace represented. We wanted to be part of that, and we wanted, believe it or not, to make it a national event, so to speak. And we were very successful at that. We really were. More so than we planned, because the demonstration, once it began, it took on a momentum of its own, meaning that our protest couldn't have been more than 10 of us Black students. And the auditorium was small enough. It was big enough. Webster Hall was big enough to accommodate hundreds of students. And so it was packed, because most of the students wanted to, almost all of them wanted to hear George Wallace's speech. He was a national figure, obviously. And so there we were, the 10 of us, just disrupting the speech. Every moment that Wallace tried to speak, a group of us in the center of the auditorium on the first floor, which included me, I think there were five of us there. We just jump up, and now all of this was planned, and just make a lot of noise. And then there were five of us or so scattered throughout the auditorium on, in the balcony, and we had banners and denouncing Wallace, et cetera. All this had been planned. And we just thought naively that a number of, this was part of the planning, that a number of the white students would join us in protesting Wallace, but that didn't happen. They wanted, they protested that we get out of the auditorium and end the protest so that they could hear Wallace speak. So that incensed us. So we became even more determined to just be disruptive. So that part of the planning of the whites not joining us, that was a surprise to us. So at one point we did leave the auditorium, disgusted with the fact that we were not able to get a part of the auditorium to join us, a student body to join us and participate in a demonstration against Wallace. So we left the auditorium, and some of the guys, Black guys involved, Black students involved in protest, they went back to their dorms or whatever, left the protest. But I and a few others, we stayed. We were locked out of the auditorium, being angry, thinking our demonstration had failed. And at one point, I jumped up on the pedestal or the base of one of the columns at Webster Hall to rally the crowd, which had gathered around us, the few of us who had been forced out of the auditorium. So I rallied them to go back in, and they were people around me. They were encouraging us to go back in. So I got caught up in the moment like everybody else, the protesting there on the outside there. And we decided to storm back into the auditorium, and the door was locked. So one of our guys, a student, big guy, was on a football player, good, very good dear friend of mine to this very day. He forced open the door. And we and by this time, when we were outside the building, a number of white students did join us. Townspeople did too, but there are whites and blacks now in the demonstration. This is something we hadn't planned. And my rallying the crowd and forcing our way back in, we hadn't planned any of that. But anyway, there we were rushing the stage, group of black students and whites now rushing the stage. And I remember very well, I wasn't sure of what the objective was, what my objective was to that point, other than to get to the stage. And I was conscious of what I was doing, but at the same time, it seemed really strange that I was doing this. So there I was, I rushed to the stage, George Wallace's security was on the stage with him, and the stage was raised from the floor level. And the podium, Wallace was behind the podium, and there I was in front of the podium, about to climb onto the stage. And I remember an Alabama state trooper putting his hand on his weapon, his gun. Yeah. And at that point, Wallace started running off the stage. And wondering, what am I doing? It was crazy in a way, meaning that wasn't planned, but just the, I learned a lot from that in many, many ways. But anyway, Wallace was now gone and forced from the stage, and the audience started leaving too. The whole thing became just total chaos. Wallace ran from the stage with his bodyguards, and the audience ran from the auditorium into the street. Wallace ran to his car, which was parked alongside Webster Hall. And so I and the other protesters, we were no longer a cohesive group, obviously, but some of us went out too. And there was just enormous crowd surrounding Wallace's car, hundreds of students, whites, blocking the car from leaving, blocking Wallace from leaving the venue. I did not participate in the rocking of the car, but I was right there when all of it was taking place. And I thought how dangerous it was and how foolish it was that we were in that situation, which could have easily gotten out of control. People could have been shot. This was that kind of a situation. New Hampshire police were there, Hanover police, the New Hampshire State Police were there, I think. In addition to the Alabama state troopers, there were also local police forces there. And they were protecting Wallace, and there was no way for the car to move. And the students were rocking the car. And the driver of the car kept trying to pull off. And after a while, he sped off. And nobody was injured by the car. And there wasn't any fighting or anything. No shots were fired. But it was that kind of a situation where it could have easily gotten out of control, and people could have been injured or wounded or whatever, and even killed. It was that kind of a situation. So after it was over, as you can imagine, there was this enormous outcry by the white students at Dartmouth, the administration of Dartmouth, alumni, to get these monkeys off the campus, expel these monkeys. That was us. And I remember being called to the football coach's office, And he showed me some of the telegrams that had come in from alumni, and we were actually called these kind of names. That's why I use the word monkeys and nappy-headed this or that. He actually showed me this stack of telegrams he, the football coach, had received. So there was a huge outcry, as I just said, for expulsion of us, for all kinds, I mean, just terrible name-calling on against us. But at any rate, the CBS National News the next day mentioned the demonstration on the national news. And Eric Severide, the commentator for CBS News at the time, Walter Cronkite was the main news presenter. He was the anchor of the program. And Eric Severide gave a commentary each evening, I think it was each evening, on the major events of the news. And the commentary he presented on that day after the Wallace demonstration was about our protests. I was shocked. And I remember some of the things he said. He talked about the racial protests in the United States, including the Dartmouth protests, obviously, but because that was the focal point of his commentary. But he put that demonstration in the context of the civil rights movement that was sweeping the country. And he even said something to the effect, as I recall, about what America's future would look like. And he, as I recall, said something to the effect that at some point, it wouldn't be so starkly racially, it wouldn't be so starkly starkly black and white, that over time there would be a more integrated society, something like that, as I recall, racially integrated society. So that it was quite an event for Dartmouth, and then also the protest was mentioned in the Los Angeles Times, the Christian Science Monitor, and some other, I was told, some other national newspapers as well. So I don't know all of that personally because I didn't read it and didn't see it myself, but some of it I did see. So it did become a national story.
Mm-hmm. What were the students' response to the protest?
The Dartmouth students?
Yeah.
Well, the white students, which was of course 99% of the student body, generally certainly opposed it. But over time, they embraced it, I think. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, they embraced it. And more importantly, at that point, early point, the administration did not expel us. We had, those of us who protested, we had to make an accounting to, it wasn't a formal court or anything like that that we had to, or a formal hearing, it was never that, but we had to meet with people in administrators, professors, and explain ourselves, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And we refused to do that, but we did meet with them, and we just simply told them why we did this and that type of thing. But we didn't express any regret about it, nothing like that at all. We were very proud of ourselves for having done that.
During those moments, did you believe you were going to be expelled, or did you know that you were going to be okay?
I thought we would be expelled. Yeah, I did.
And how did you feel about that?
I hadn't thought about it before the demonstration. I didn't think the demonstration would end that way that it did. I thought that, as I said earlier, our planning was to create enough disruption to prevent Wallace from speaking. But we also thought that enough whites would join us and would block the speech, and that it would end in that way. And it wouldn't be just as we wouldn't have a group, the black student, stand out as the instigator of this riot. This new, riot, yes. This mob, the instigators of this mob. So we didn't expect that things would turn out that way, but they did. And so after then, I thought about possibility of being expelled, because that was a real possibility. But beforehand, I hadn't thought about anything like that. But I wasn't worried or anxious about it at all, not at all, just after the demonstration, because I thought that I and the others had done the right thing. So it didn't bother me. And then later, once I graduated from Dartmouth and et cetera, then I realized, man, maybe we shouldn't have done that because it was too risky. But at the time, I didn't see it that way at all.
So I was going through the Rahner archives on the George Wallace incident. And I noticed that for several months, like after the event at Dartmouth, they're still getting lots of like hate letters that you were like talking about earlier, the telegrams, referring to Black students as Black apes and ugly cockroaches and comparing them to Nazis and many other hurtful things. Did the administration try to protect Black students from this negativity, or did they continue to show you all of that?
I don't recall the administration trying to protect us in any way whatsoever. No. Mm-hmm.
I went on about, after the demonstration, I went to class like I always did, and classes were not canceled or anything. We all went about our own normal activities, although there was this tremendous, not undercurrent, but this tremendous current that we could all see and feel that was taking place on the campus because of the demonstration. But it didn't change our routines, not at all. And like I said, the administration, as far as I know, there definitely wasn't any attempt on their part to try to shield us from anything. It may have been impossible for them to do anything like that, even if they had wanted to, and I don't know if they wanted to or not, but they did not expel us.
During that time period, like after the protest, did you feel safe?
Yes, very much so. Before the protest, I felt safe at Dartmouth. After the protest, I felt safe at Dartmouth. Absolutely.
So there was no confrontation with white students?
No, not at all. No, I didn't. And I don't know of any confrontation that any of the other Black students had because of the protest.
So like overall, would you say Dartmouth was pretty supportive? Or do you think they were just like neutral?
Overall, did I think they were just neutral, or if they were, I don't understand what you're saying.
About the protests and the activism, do you think they were supporting and like trying to make a difference, or they just like left it as is?
The white students?
The administration, white students.
The administration? Oh gosh, a lot of things happened positive for Dartmouth after the Wallace protest. And administration was part of that. Shabazz Hall. The name, I don't remember. I think at first it was called, the building was called, or the center was called, the Afro-Am House, I think, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then it was later named Shabazz Hall. The recruitment of Black students began in earnest by our group. Meaning the Afro-Am Society, that generation of Black students who were there in the 1960s. So these were positive steps that the administration began to take to really make Dartmouth different and to begin to embrace us. One would have thought, well, today it might be different in America, but today there may have something like that took place. That demonstration took place, clearly I believe today would have been extremely violent and a lot of pushback from the whites. But at that time, in this particular location, this particular setting in Dartmouth, there was a real concerted effort on the part of the administration to try to work with the Afro-American Society leadership and other Black students to bring change to Dartmouth in terms of enrollment of Black students, Shabazz Society, and bringing Black professors to Dartmouth, creation of the
Afro-American Studies Department. All of these things came out of these policies, these programs came out of the protest movement of the 1960s, not just student protest movement, not just the George Wallace demonstration, because there were other demonstrations across the country. And the George Wallace demonstration simply put Dartmouth on the map, so to speak, in terms of this protest movement. And fortunately, the administration response was to try to embrace change. And so a lot, and African-American students at Dartmouth became agents of that change, not only in terms of forcing, if you will, it to happen or take place, but also became instruments in bringing about the change. African-American students began to get funding from the university as a result of initiative African-American students at Dartmouth to travel across the country and recruit Black students to attend Dartmouth. And then in time, get the administration support to bring Black faculty to Dartmouth, et cetera. So all, and then to start the African-American Studies Department, which became the African-American Studies, or the African-American Studies Department, something like that, AAAS, AAAS, or whatever it is. That all began with the initiative there, the 1960s. That generation, not just the class of 1969, class of 68, class of 1970, class of 1971, that type of thing. And eventually, all of this protest led to the, and this probably is missed, I think in some part, led to the admission of women students at Dartmouth. So the admission of white women students at Dartmouth, including a handful of Blacks, that came out of this whole protest movement of the 1960s initiated by the Black students. It forced a tremendous change in Dartmouth. And not only, like I said, eventually bringing in white students, or women students, sort of like the civil, not sort of like, but like the civil rights movement in the broader, in the country itself as a whole. From that civil rights struggle of Blacks initiated, operated, run by Blacks, et cetera, staffed by Blacks, et cetera, and the Black participants on a mass basis, et cetera, that brought about all kinds of other change in the United States. Change for gender equality, women's rights, that type of thing. That followed the Black movement, resistance, et cetera. Just like in the 1800s, it was the same thing. The fight against slavery led to the fight for women's rights in the United States as well, and the forming of the National Women's Organization in the United States for the first time. Well, the same thing happened at Dartmouth. The Black students protesting racism in a very aggressive public way, forcing the establishment, if you will, to make changes to accommodate Black people, also segued into white people resisting too, and bringing about change for whites, including the mission, as I've said several times, the mission of white women at Dartmouth, and then Black women as well. And that part of the story may be oftentimes missed in terms of Black, white women students at Dartmouth. I don't know, I don't have much to do with Dartmouth, but so I don't really know the official story of, I know it's to some extent of white women getting being admitted to Dartmouth, but my guess is they don't tell the story too much about the Black students being a key part of the 1960s, that generation being a key part in enforcing the establishment at Dartmouth to eventually admit women.
Did you like play any other role like in regards to activism for women?
No, I did not, no. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so on April 11th, 1969, a 1949 graduate, Samuel W. Smith, was appointed Assistant Director of Admissions. And this was one of the 18 demands issued by the Afro-American Society. Is this ringing a bell?
I was part of the Afro-American Society, but I don't think I was part of that actual protest. So, but I'm familiar with it generally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So do you remember like the 18 demands that they wrote, the Afro American Society, there are 18 demands. I think they're ranging from like adding the African American studies, adding more
professors,
Black students, like recruiting Black students, and a bunch of also
the Amherst,
yeah,
that was part of it too, I believe.
Can you tell me a little bit about what you remember about that?
I was not directly involved with that. There were other students who took the initiative to lead that. I was not one of them. Mm-hmm. And that by that time, that was what, April 1969, I was leaving Dartmouth, though still part of the Afro-American Society, et cetera, but not one of the leaders at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm familiar with the protest, that particular protest, like I said earlier.
Okay, so during all this time, like what was your motivation?
My motivation for what?
Preparing for like African-American rights and more like on campus.
What was my motivation for pushing for African-American rights on campus?
Yeah.
Well, it's the same motivation throughout my life, resisting the status quo that oppress Black people or push Black people to the bottom of the society. And I mean, we were not my generation of Black students was not the first qualified generation of Black students to attend Dartmouth, by no means. There'd been plenty of qualified Black students to attend Dartmouth years and decades before. So, but we were not there. So why? Well, we know why we were not there. My efforts activism at Dartmouth was consistent with the resistance to the established quo, the establishment's imposed status quo on the way things were in America. And Dartmouth was obviously an example of the way things were in America. So our protest was resistance to that. That was my motivation, to resist that.
From your 4 years at Dartmouth College, what were some of your proudest moments or memories?
My proudest moments or memories?
Mm-hmm.
I would say the Wallace protest was one of them. That was definitely one of them. Another proud moment for me was winning the oratorical contest as a senior, the college's oratorical contest, which was the Benjamin F. Barge speech contest. One student had to write a speech and present a speech at a college audience and be voted on for the prize. So I won that prize as a senior, and my prize money was $150, which I used to buy as part of the money to buy my $200 round trip air ticket between New York and London for my first travel abroad. So that was a proud moment for me too. Another proud moment for me was the way the African-American students, the Black students really came together and brought the kind of change at Dartmouth that we did. That's very, very significant. And then one other aspect of the change was also the students, certainly the Black students at Dartmouth were no longer just students from the Black elite in the United States. My father was not a doc. I never knew my father, but my family members did not have doctors, medical doctors or lawyers or small business owners. We were not government civil servants. We were not part of the Black elite in the United States, the middle class, upper middle class, et cetera. That was new. These were now working class Black students at Dartmouth. And also my guess is, this is something I don't know, but perhaps someone at some time in the future can look at this too, is the composition of the white students may have changed a bit as well. Dartmouth became less elite. I think it may have begun to admit working class white students in some appreciable numbers too, which it did not do before. It began to make the changes for black students, and these changes instigated by blacks. Oftentimes what happens in the United States, which is exactly the same at Dartmouth that I just described, the blacks people, because of our condition here in the United States, have taken the initiative of resistance and bringing about change to this resistance to the establishment status quo. And other groups in the society have piggybacked on that resistance movement, protest movement initiated and pushed or driven by black people. And as a result, the whole society changes. So I think that happened at Dartmouth as well, as I mentioned with regard to the women being admitted to Dartmouth. So it's now a co-ed university. Without the black students protest, that may not have happened, certainly may not have happened at that particular time. It probably would have happened over time, but at the same time, it did happen when it did, in large part because of the black student protest, et cetera. So the type of changes that we brought about the black student brought about Dartmouth, that's a very proud moment for me as well. And I think the black students should be given full credit for that.
Did attending Dartmouth change your perspective on white people?
No, not really. Meaning that it was my experiences there was my first experience to the white elite in the country, a day-to-day experience. But my perspective about white people and the establishment, no, it did not undergo any fundamental change. That somehow they were more liberal or more giving, whatever, than I had a thought in the past. They were not, are not today, et cetera. So I had that view going into Dartmouth, and I left with that view as well.
When was the last time you visited Dartmouth?
Since I graduated from Dartmouth, I think I've been there maybe three times.
Since you graduated?
Yeah, in 50, how many years ago? 52 years, I think I've been to Dartmouth maybe three times. Each time I was invited by administration, or maybe I've been twice. I was invited by the administration. Once I was invited by the administration. I was invited by the administration some capacity, three times out there. And the last time I was there, I was invited to speak at Tuck School about my doing work in Africa. This would have been about maybe 2012 or something like that. And after graduating from Dartmouth, and I did not bother to go to the graduation, by the way, my graduation, I skipped that. It must have been 20 years after I graduated before I went back. So maybe three times in 52 years.
Mm-hmm. What made you decide to skip your graduation?
What made me decide? For me, it was a statement of rejecting that culture. Basically it. I had achieved what I wanted to achieve from Dartmouth, which was getting the degree. And for me, I'm gonna repeat myself, not attending the graduation was a statement of my rejection of that elitist culture.
Did any other students follow your footsteps?
There were, I know of several other black students who at least one who did not attend the graduation, but that one.
When you were back at Dartmouth, did you notice any similarities or differences from when you were a student here?
Not really, other than the number of black students there. I was not really engaged with the student body very much when I was there. I was there on a handful of times. I were two or three. I know I was there at least twice. I was there a third time too. I went there to see a friend not too long after I graduated. I went to visit a friend who was still at Dartmouth. So I've been to Dartmouth three times since I graduated, 52 years. So just, like I said, I wasn't engaged with the students in any way whatsoever on occasions that I was there. I could just see that there were a number of Black students there, obviously far more, like several hundred, I think maybe 400 students. And when I was there, it was 30 or something. So anyway, so I didn't really look for much change because I just wasn't involved with Dartmouth and even now I'm not involved with Dartmouth, except I am part of two Zoom meeting groups. One is a group of Dartmouth alumni. We meet twice a month. By Zoom, sharing our stories of our experiences at Dartmouth and having those experiences recorded for archival purposes. We started during the pandemic, 2020. I think it may have started around April or so of 2020. I was asked to join the group, invited to join it by July or something. And I've been a regular participant since that time. So that's my involvement with Dartmouth, along with being a member of a Concerned Black Alumni of Dartmouth, CBAD. And I think it's CBAD, Concerned Black Alumni of Dartmouth, that spearheaded or prompted this archival interview. So I'm a member of that as well. And that's a small group. There may be about 15 of us or something like that, at most 12 of us, at most 15, maybe 12, 10 to 15 of us who meet every so often to discuss changes that should be brought into at Dartmouth to push for change for Black students, Black faculty at Dartmouth, et cetera, increased enrollment, increased Black faculty. Now is an effort to promote the building of a Black Intellectual Life Center at Dartmouth or something like that. So I'm part of that group. I was asked to join that group. And Woody Lee, the first president, or Forrester Lee, the first president of Afro-American Society, he's one of the 12, 15 members of the group, and so am I. But I'm not one of the leaders of that group. Woody Lee is, or Forrester Lee is, but I'm not. That group is led by Tyrone Byrd, class of 1973, and Maria Cole, class of 83, I think.
What role did you play in that?
I'm one of the members, I suggest strategies or whatever, meaning that I'm one of the participants who pretty much go along with what the leadership say. But no, I express my opinion as to how we should go about whatever the objectives are. I'm glad that I am part of that. And so these two activities, the CBAD, Concerned Black Alumni of Dartmouth, and this Black Alumni Group, the formal name is HHP Hanover Partners or something like that, initiative of some kind or another. I'm not too sure beyond what I described as a formal name, but I'm part of both those, and we do those meetings, handle those meetings by Zoom.
Are you planning on visiting Dartmouth anytime soon?
No, I'm not. There's one of the professors in the AA, the African American African Studies Department, has indicated that they would like for me to come to Dartmouth and speak, share some of my experiences with the student body there, which I'd like to do. But at the moment, no formal invitation. And I think maybe you have to wait till the pandemic is a bit over, or whatever. But I love to come. And my experiences in my lifetime have been quite a bit different from that probably of most graduates of Dartmouth.
Yeah. So tell me a little. Oh, do you have anything else you want to add about your experience at Dartmouth?
Anything I want to add?
Mm-hmm. About your experience at Dartmouth.
Anything I want to add about my experiences at Dartmouth, or what I experienced at Dartmouth?
Mm-hmm.
Not really. I don't think so. Except to say that I'm really happy that I went to Dartmouth. It was a great experience for me. It really was. In many ways, in the course of this interview, I hope I've described some of those ways in which it was a great experience for me. But it was. It really, really was. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever like have any periods where like you regretted your choice to choose Dartmouth, or have you always been like happy with your choice?
Okay, say that one more time. Try what?
Have you ever like regretted your choice of attending Dartmouth?
Have I ever regretted it? If I had the choice of going to Dartmouth again, I think I would. No, I've never ever regretted it. No, not at all. It was a great experience. No question about it. I am very, very happy with my decision to attend Dartmouth. There were no regrets whatsoever, no.
So tell me a little about life after Dartmouth.
I was just looking at the time here. As you know from my biographical material that you've seen, I became an attorney. I went to Yale Law School, which was a very interesting experience. Now that was a situation where it was like a fish out of water there, because I just didn't fit there at all. It was even more elitist than Dartmouth. And that just, no, that, I don't regret going there, not at all. Again, one of the reasons I don't regret is that it's important to, at certainly at this stage in America, when I was there, certainly the case and now as well, it's certainly important to be able to function in a society at the highest level that one can, and having the necessary credentials to do that is important. And Dartmouth afforded me that, and so does a Yale Law School degree as well. It assists me in that purpose. Even with working on campaign for this candidate for president of Somalia, the fact that I went to Yale Law School, it's credentials. It's an asset to the candidate, and he uses it wherever he can to say that this man who graduated from Yale Law School, et cetera, graduated from Dartmouth College, is helping to lead his campaign. So it's important to have those kind of credentials. And so my experiences at Yale Law School, though I was a fish out of water in that cauldron of elitism, nonetheless, I'm glad I was there. So then after Yale, and even while I was at Yale, my experiences in Africa began. And actually before too, because I traveled to Africa for the first time immediately after graduating from Dartmouth. I traveled to Europe, hitchhiked through Europe, 15 countries in Europe, and 3 in North Africa, the summer of 1969. And that was a truly transformative experience for me. one of the most exciting, transformative experiences of my life. And it changed my life in the sense that while I had been interested in Africa long before the travel, once I began to travel to Africa, it fundamentally altered my life and the path that I took. And so I became very much engaged in doing activities, activism in Africa, working with the African National Liberation Movement in South Africa, which is primarily the African National Congress, Mr. Mandela's group, et cetera. Working in various other African countries on many different kinds of activities, many, many different kinds of activities, and traveling to 25 African countries over the course of the years and continuing to do work in Africa today. So that's the kind of activities in a broad scope, so to speak, that I've been engaged in and, since I graduated. Although I've also practiced law, I also practiced law for many years, and I did fairly well at that in Chicago. But I combined that with consulting practices, consulting practice in Africa. And consulting practice is what I still do in Africa. And I really enjoy that. And I try to make a difference in some of the ventures in which I've been engaged. And I think I have significant difference in some ways.
Can you elaborate on some of the ways you've made a difference?
In South Africa, of course, the ANC came to power, and my activities, although small scale, began in 1970 when I met the African National Congress Exile Leadership in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. Interacted with them for about a month during my visit to East Africa in 1970. And I worked with them for years, being part of protests here in the United States, of anti-apartheid protests here in the United States, acting as a lawyer and several demonstrations to get people out of jail who have participated in demonstration, myself when I was never arrested. One of the reasons, I think, maybe because I knew I had to try to get the others out who had been arrested. But anyway, I remember demonstrating against South African apartheid government outside the U.S., their consulate in Chicago, that we used to demonstrate on a weekly basis or something like that. And I was there. Then later, I worked with them during a transition after Mr. Mandela was released from prison and had the just tremendous blessing, or good blessing, if you will, to be at the negotiating table in 1972, May 15, 16, 1972, when the new constitution was being discussed on the type of changes that should be made, type of provisions that should go into the new constitution. It was an amazing experience. So I think in some way, some small way, my being a part of that and being a part of that through people I knew, personal contact that I had made with people, personal relationship with people who were longtime members of the African National Congress. So that's how I got that kind of access. And so to some extent, it made a difference there. And then also in West Africa, participating in the development of some major infrastructure projects, such as the West Africa Gas Pipeline, which I worked to develop as a consultant for the Chevron International Petroleum Corporation. And so it's a pipeline that goes from Nigeria to Ghana. And I was instrumental in making that happen. And there's some other kinds of activities as well. So I think so.
How did you get involved in working with Nelson Mandela? Like, where did you meet your connections? Where did you meet your connections?
I mentioned in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. Before that point, I, of course, as I mentioned earlier, I participated in at least one demonstration, at anti-apartheid demonstration at Dartmouth. And then in Chicago, my home, while I was in at Dartmouth and Yale, had a very active anti-apartheid movement. And I was part of that movement in Chicago. I first met the Exile African National Congress leadership, as I mentioned, in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, in 1970. I hitchhiked through five countries, East African countries, in 1970, landing in Nairobi, taking a train in Mombasa, Kenya, and then train from Mombasa to Moshi in Tanzania, then to Dar es Salaam. And I spent about a month in Dar es Salaam. And that's where I met the ANC, hitchhiked across Tanzania to Burundi, Rwanda, Uganda, and back to Nairobi. But at any rate, I met the exile leadership in Dar es Salaam in 1970. I did not meet Mr. Mandela until, obviously, until he was, after he was released from prison. Released from prison in 1991. And I think it was in 1991 that I first met him. There was a conference at Westville University in Durban, South Africa, of the ANC leadership that had been in exile since the 1960s when Mr. Mandela was sentenced to prison. They met, I think it was 1991, and I attended that conference. And these delegates were seeing each other for the first time since they were in South Africa for the first time since the 1960s, 1961, 62, et cetera. They were meeting Mandela. They were seeing each other for the first time in all those years. They were also seeing Mr. Mandela for the first time in all those years. That's where I met Nelson Mandela for the first time.
What was your experience with working with him like?
Well, I was around him more than I was directly engaged with him, except I was directly engaged with him when he visited Chicago in 1993. I was one of his hosts for the visit in Chicago. And there I was directly engaged with him in terms of raising money for the election campaign. So I was one of his hosts, had hosted a reception for him, had raised money among African-American lawyers and other lawyers too, white lawyers as well, but primarily African-American lawyers. And then I and my family, we visited him in his hotel room. I had my mother, my wife at the time, my children and my mother, we all went to his hotel room. We sat there, talked with him, met him, talked with him, and it was a very nice family discussion type meeting, gathering. And then I met him in a home, home settings in South Africa several times, or a number of times. One of my best friends in South Africa was a member of his cabinet, the first cabinet in 1994. And he and his wife were close to Mr. Mandela. So Mandela attended their wedding. This gentleman was one of my best, he was my best South African friend at the time. And so I was staying at his home and Mandela was there and for the wedding along with his wife, Graca Michelle. And I had known Graca Michelle since before Mandela was in, released. I met Graca, I think, in 1987 or so in Chicago. She was a former wife of President of Mozambique, Samora Michelle, who was killed in an airplane crash. And Graca was an activist herself. And since I was involved in Southern African Liberation Movement activism, I hosted a reception for her at my home in Chicago. This was long before Mandela was released from prison and long before he married her. So I remember being in my friend's home and Mandela was there and Graca was there. And Graca and I knew each other. Mandela wanted to know, and he was standing there, so he wanted to know how Grasso knew me. But we both explained why she was in Chicago in my home.
So you mentioned how you were married and you had kids. During, like, what was the timeline of that? Like, when did you have the time to get married and have kids and all of that?
Well, I I have three children. Two sons and a daughter. I mean, I went to work every day. So, yeah, I had plenty of time. Even now, I have plenty of time. Just requires a discipline, one discipline life, so to speak, organized life.
When were they all born? When were your kids born?
Oh, yeah. Birthdays are coming up. I keep reminding myself, don't forget. Okay, my daughter's birthday is on November 2nd, next Tuesday, born in 1977. My oldest son, his birthday, no, let me make sure because I can't forget that birthday. November 19th is the birthday of my youngest son. He was born in 1982. And December 3rd is the birthday of my oldest son. He was born in December 3rd, 1979. So I have to remember those birthdays so I can wish them happy birthday.
When did you get married?
I got married in 1974. So yeah, 1974. That would have been, how old was I, 27?
So how did you meet your wife?
Mount Holyoke. She was a graduate of Mount Holyoke. Met her when she was there.
So earlier you mentioned how like you and a couple friends would go to the nearby colleges. And is that when you met her?
The first part.
You said earlier that during your time at Dartmouth, because it's all a male school, you and a couple friends would go travel to nearby colleges. Is that when you met your wife?
Right. When the Black male students were admitted to these East Coast schools, the Ivy League schools, over time, a short period of time after first of us arrived at these schools, such as Dartmouth, Black female students were admitted to these various schools as well, that is the women's schools. So I met her in the course of some dance or something like that at Dartmouth.
She attended Dartmouth or?
Mount Holyoke.
Oh, okay. And where is that located?
In Massachusetts. Oh, women's college. They still exist, these all women. I don't know if they are all women now, but some men may attend. But when I was at Dartmouth, there were all women's colleges and all men's colleges.
Okay, looking back at your life, what would you consider to be your greatest accomplishment?
I just mentioned one. For me, the greatest accomplishment, aside from my children, probably, is, and I've said this before, is a liberated mind. A liberated mind. That's by far my greatest accomplishment.
Can you elaborate on what that means for you?
Just briefly. My daughter, hold on. Let me call you back. Okay. Always have to answer her calls. What I mean by that is that it's difficult for African Americans, for not just African Americans, for Black people in the world, African Americans included, to see ourselves as people, just like white people, so to speak. Meaning people with the same capacity in every way, intellectually, et cetera, as white people, as Chinese people, et cetera. And we have that capacity to change the world, to shape the world, the same as any other people do. It's very easy for Black people to think that white people are the superior force in the world, superior capacity in every way. And that's not true. We Black people can shape the world just as any other people can do. And I learned that. And one day, as we continue to move forward, we will continue to reshape the world. We will. Mm-hmm. We will do that. Mm-hmm. We don't have to look to white people to define ourselves. We don't have to look to white people to define the world, to shape the world to come. We can do that too, and we will do it. That's what I mean by a liberated mind.
Was there ever a time period where you looked at white people to define you? Or like you took—
White people what?
Where you didn't have like a liberated mind and you valued like white people.
Oh yeah, sure. I mean, just growing up in the South, growing up in America, I mean, white people are the dominant force, the dominant power in every way here in the United States. And if one doesn't know the outside world, how would you know that there's another world, a world in which the white people have met their match, so to speak? China, for example. And so, yeah, I grew up under the dome too, under this umbrella like everybody else here. And it took me a while to get out from under that umbrella and see that other world. And the travels abroad helped me to do that, including the travels to Europe. Those were my first travels to Europe, 15 countries in Europe, and then the three in North Africa I talked about. It helped me to see the world in a very different perspective than what I was taught here in the United States. And that's that was an extremely liberating experience for me.
What motivated you to take that trip and travel all along Africa and Europe?
Well, I saw that I could do that, afford that. I'd always thought that was out of my reach, but at Dartmouth I saw, and that was a significant experience for me at Dartmouth as well. There was a poster I saw on one of the bulletin boards at Dartmouth, and it advertised a round trip ticket to Europe for about, I think it was $202 or $224 or something like that. This is a candidate I work for, hold on. So I saw that poster and I thought, I can do that. I can afford that. I can make the money to do that. And I won that speech contest. It was $150. So that was almost my entire round trip ticket. And then I worked, had a little barbershop at Dartmouth to cut the Black guy's hair. I made just a handful of dollars. But then I also had savings from my summer jobs. And then there was this book for the first time published by an author named Arthur Frommer, F-R-O-M-M-E-R. Europe on $5 a day. I bought that book and I was able to travel to Europe with my girlfriend, who became my wife, and her high school age sister. Her father would not let her, my girlfriend's father would not let her travel hitchhiking through Europe and Africa unless the sister, the high school age sister, went also. So there I was with myself, my girlfriend from Mount Holyoke, who became my wife, and her 11th grade high school sister. We hitchhiked to those 18 countries.
What was your wife's name?
Her name was Maisha, or Bobby Hamilton, and then later Maisha.
Can you spell that out for me?
M-A-I-S-H-A. East African name, Swahili name, Maisha, M-A-I-S-H-A.
Sorry, I forgot the question I was about to ask. Where did you sleep and how did you, how did you afford to travel, like, once you got to those countries, once you got to, like, Europe?
Well, the Europe on $5 a day was a compilation of travel information in each of the countries of Western Europe. Eastern Europe was a communist area at the time, communist ruled countries at the time. And so the book did not cover Eastern Europe, but it did cover Western Europe. Hotels, places to stay at hotels. I mean, really cheap hotels, $5 a day. Hotels, places to eat, also a hotel or student hostels, et cetera, all on $5 a day. Bus fares, ferry fares, train fares, the cheapest, et cetera. So that was my travel guide. That was our travel guide. And my girlfriend and her sister, they had much more money than I did. I had the bare minimum, but their father made sure that they had enough money. But for me, I had the bare minimum. So, but they followed everything I did. So that's how we made it. And so it was on that basis. That book was what I used daily to figure out where we were gonna stay, how we were gonna get to where we were going, et cetera. So I was like the tour guide for the two of them. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. I think you mentioned before that you slept on the side of the highways if you couldn't afford. You slept on the side of the highways?
Oh, yes, I did. We did, not just I, but the three of us, the two ladies as well, two women. In Italy was where we, in Austria, it was 1969, we were hitchhiking through the Alps, and the day that Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landed on the moon, we were staying overnight and sleeping on the floor of a gas station. Had a television, and we watched the moon landing. This was in Austria. In Italy, we slept alongside the highway twice. This is in southern Italy. We're hitchhiking from Rome to Palermo, Sicily, to take a boat to Tunis, ship to Tunis. And at that time, a very poor area, for me, but traveling, hitchhiking through southern Italy, very, very poor people, Italians. And so there are very few cars. So one day we were just hitchhiking, no cars. So we just slept on the side of the road. when we hitchhiked from Austria to Venice, Italy, this was before the highway trip that I just described, but we had hitchhiked to Venice. And we got there at night, late at night, and we, hate to say it, I'm not gonna say it. We slept on there was a train siding, I'll say it, a boxcar, a train, cargo, a boxcar. So we just slept there. Door was open, we just slept there until daylight, then we got a hotel. Then in North Africa, very little traffic between Tunis and Eastern Algeria. very, very little traffic. So we couldn't, so we just slept on the side of the road. Until the next day when the traffic was more, whatever. So I think that happened. We had that, and then in Prague, we were in Czechoslovakia too. I took a train to Czechoslovakia, to Prague, and we got there at night. We're at the train station and it's too late to go try to find a hotel. So we just slept on the ground at the train station.
Can you give
I wouldn't do those type of things today. I would not. And then with the two ladies with me, I definitely would not do anything like that today. It's the Europe is very different today than it was back then.
Were you ever? Before I ask my question, can you give me a time period of all those travels?
What about other travels?
Time period.
Oh gosh, I've traveled so many times. I've traveled to Africa well more than 100 times. So, and whenever I travel to Africa, I always go through Europe, going and coming. So you can imagine, and then many times I would simply spend a day somewhere in London or Paris or Frankfurt or wherever. So you can imagine how many times I've been to Europe, just many, many times. But this has been over the course of 1969, that's over the course of 52 years. And 1 year I traveled to Africa, 8 times from the United States, 8 times. And then sometimes in Africa, depending on the kind of business I had, I would travel from, say, Accra, Ghana to London, take care of business there, and then back to Accra. So lots and lots of travel.
Does your job fund all of these trips, or?
Right. My clients funded the trips, yeah. I haven't paid for myself to travel to Europe since 1970, I think.
Was that when you hitchhiked?
That was the second time I hitchhiked, yeah.
Mm-hmm. When was the first time, like the year?
1969, soon after I graduated from Dartmouth. Second year was 1970, I hitchhiked again. This time it was through East Africa, and as I described earlier, and also Turkey, spent 10 days in Turkey.
And did you say they were each 3 months long, or how long were you there for? Like, how long did you hitchhike for?
How long was what now?
Your trips, your first two trips.
Oh, that was the entire summer. When the 69, mm-hmm. 1969, I left in June, right after the Dartmouth graduation, whenever that was, although I did not attend the graduation. Nonetheless, I left around the time of the graduation until I started at Yale Law School in September of 1969. So that travel was about 3 months, a little more than 3 months, June, July, August. Yeah, more about the, maybe three months and a week or so, something like that. And same with 1970.
I think that's all the questions I have for you right now. Is there anything
right
else
now.
To add? Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, just thank you very much for the opportunity to tell my story, and I hope you found it interesting.
I definitely did. One last question, actually. Do you have any advice for any current students, Dartmouth students of color?
Yeah. Yes, I would say that take the initiative to obtain this liberated mind that I spoke about. That not taught to you. I'm certain it is not being taught to you, and is not likely to be taught to you. Taught, T-A-U-G-H-T, is something you will have to attain on your own, and that's important. So I would advise, do that. Definitely so.
Okay. Thank you so much for spending the past couple of hours with me. I really appreciate everything you've said, and I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you very much. Okay, I appreciate that. Okay, take care, and you know how to reach me if you need me for anything.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm gonna stop the recording now.
Okay, good night now. Mm-hmm.